Hey everybody, happy Sunday.
Yeah, we're back.
Hopefully you're having a good weekend.
Jenny's still sniffling a little bit.
I don't maybe I'm developing allergies in my old
I
age. I
don't
don't feel
know.
like I'm sick or anything like that, but I do have a little bit of like a sinus headache.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And I didn't drink much last night. I had one drink and I didn't even finish it, I think. I think I fell asleep at like 6:30 watching Riff Tracks.
I don't know what it was. I can't tell. And a little rubber thing fell off my glasses.
Again.
I got more of them. It might be in here.
It's probably in here.
It's probably in here.
Pookie will eat it if you leave it
No.
around. She just like,
Oh.
well, she does. She goes around. She goes around on the carpet. And she
Yeah.
like that. You can hear her snuffling around the carpet, and then she finds some random shit. And she's like, oh, okay, I'll just eat this. I don't know what it is. Just
Yeah.
fucking lint and stuff. You
Yeah.
know, she'll
All
eat
right.
anything.
We're gonna talk about the new Creepshow season that came. Well, it's the
It's
episode.
season 2, episode 3.
Right.
That's a new one,
And
yeah.
then we're going to talk about The Loved One. We finished
From
that movie.
1965.
Yeah, interesting movie.
You want to talk about Creepshow first?
Yeah, go ahead and
Because
knock
like I said,
Creepshow out.
I don't want to like spoil it because like I said, that's new.
Yeah.
I'm not as worried about it with The Loved One because that's a really old movie. But yeah, so the latest Creepshow, okay, I'm gonna say that this one I liked it better, I think, than the last episode, but the first story is way better than the second story. That's what I'm gonna say. So this one, the first story is called The Right Snuff.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really funny. Kind of a riff on 2001: A Space Odyssey, a little
Yeah.
bit. I was actually kind of impressed at
The
the
sets.
production design and stuff like that, which
Yeah.
the budget for Creepshow is not very high. So they actually do a lot of really good work with not a lot of not a lot of money, which is very admirable.
Yeah, they kind of emulate 2001: A Space Odyssey. The sets, the interiors, and the exterior shots pretty well.
Yeah,
They
I mean,
actually
it
count
looked
pretty
really
good.
cool. But yeah,
Yeah.
there was even like some little Hal jokes and shit like that in the background. But
Yeah.
it's basically the story is, and like I said, I'm not going to spoil it or anything, but the story is there's two astronauts. Their names are Alex and Ted, right? One of
Yeah.
them's like the captain, and one of them is like the scientific genius. He's invented something that, what does it do? It has like some kind of, it can warp gravity or
Yeah,
something.
it's like a gravity drive
Yeah,
type
something
deal.
like that. So he's invented that, but the pilot, I guess his dad was the first dude. I don't know what year this is supposed to be set, but his dad was a famous pilot too, and he was like the first guy to land on Mars, right? So he's kind of like there's a lot of stuff about him not being able to like live up to his dad. Like he has kind of flashbacks about his dad being like, "You'll never be good enough," and like all that kind of stuff. But so then it turns out that we have contacted aliens, and so Houston sends like the little genius guy. He wants to send the little genius guy out to talk to the aliens, and the captain is not too happy about it because he wants to be the guy because he wants to go into the history books
Yeah.
as the guy that talked to the aliens.
Yeah, now you do see the aliens and you find out what happens, but none of that shit can be spoiled. The acting was good, the story was pretty good. The special effects when came to the aliens were kind of cartoonish, and they're supposed to be. It's the
Yeah, it
tone
was a very
of,
Mars Attacks,
yeah,
like
like Mars Attacks.
50s, which I liked. I liked
Yeah.
that they pulled that off really well. It
Yeah,
was
it was
cool looking.
cool. The story wasn't too complicated. You're not talking about an ultra sophisticated story, but it's with the inside the tone of Creepshow. It worked. It was
Yeah,
interesting.
you don't see a lot of sci-fi stories on Creepshow. Was
Yeah.
this kind of maybe, was this the first one?
Yeah, it's one I only one I
I
remember.
can't really think of it. Maybe there was, or just
Yeah.
like just because I haven't watched the first season in a while. Like I saw a couple of the episodes the other
The
day,
story
but
is actually a lot like, I mean, you can tell 2001 is what they're
yeah,
ripping
that's kind
off.
of what the inside of the ship looks
Right.
like. That's what a lot of the
Yeah, which that's great the way they did that. But the type of story that it is it's kind of more like something out of the animated movie Heavy Metal. It's more like something like the Loch Nahr story of the Loch
The
Nahr
story
and
of
all
the Loch Nahr.
yeah. Which that's hey, if you guys haven't seen fucking Heavy Metal, see Heavy Metal.
We
That's
still
good.
haven't
That's
reviewed that. Maybe we should
yeah.
do a matinee on that one of these days because I keep
Yeah.
putting it in the poll for the retrospective and it always keeps losing.
Yeah, that's a forgotten classic. And some of the deleted stuff, it's on the Blu-ray. That's
We
really cool
should
too.
do Heavy Metal and Fire and Ice on one
Yeah.
thing because I think Fire and Ice might be on Tubi or it was last time I looked on
Yeah.
there.
Gotta see Fire and Ice. It's been a long time. I used to like it back in the day, but I kind of have a feeling that maybe the story really isn't there. I'd have to see it again.
Yeah.
I'd have to see it again.
Now, the second story on the Creepshow was called Sibling Rivalry. Now, this one was about a teenage girl at a high school, and it opens with her telling her, I guess it's the guidance counselor, played by Molly Ringwald, y'all. Yeah. I was very excited about
this. She's still cute. She's still good looking.
She looks almost, I mean, they made her look, you know, like a mom, like a guidance counselor in this one, like with the hair and the kind of frumpy clothes and stuff, but it's like, you could still tell it was her.
No,
and
she still had the cougar look.
Yeah.
You still hit that.
And she's not, I think she's 4 or 5 years older than me.
Yeah, she's my age.
Yeah, so because like I said, I think she was born in 68, early 68.
Okay, so it's just, she's a little bit older than me, actually.
Yeah, she's a little bit older. She still looks really good. Yeah, but I love that they made her the guidance counselor in this.
Yeah.
So this is about a teenage girl, and she's telling the guidance counselor that her brother is trying to kill her, and she's telling like this big rambling kind of story about it. But so basically, it's just kind of like this story of her relating that her brother is trying to kill her, but then there's not a lot to it. Then there's like a twist, which I can't really spoil. I didn't love this one.
It was just okay.
This one was okay. Yeah. It ran into the same problem. If you guys saw the kind of one-off animated one, the one that had Survivor type, and then the other one was based on the Joe Hill story, like tweeting, what was it called? Tweeting from the Circuits of the Dead or something. Anything that's narrated by a teenage girl, like in full-on fucking teenage girl mode, like over the top.
Because
I was like, I don't know, maybe teenage girls nowadays do talk like that, but I kind of feel like it's overwrought a little bit. You know what I'm saying?
It usually was. I remember when they tried to pretend like they were teenagers in a story back in the 80s. You're like, man, nobody talks like that.
Yeah, so I kind of feel like maybe that's the case here. You know what I'm saying?
From what I'm understanding, those teenagers up to date are pretty fucking dumb, though.
They're probably teenagers of all era are always dumb.
They think they know everything.
That's kind of one of the defining traits of a teenager is that they think they're smarter than everybody else, but really they don't know anything.
They don't know the fuck they're talking about, right?
That's just how that works. Yeah. Like I said, fucking, I think that Aristotle was complaining about that like thousands of years ago. Yeah. These damn teenagers, get off my lawn!
Real mentally quick, a lot of agility, good verbal dexterity, no wisdom. Just dumb.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, and you can't expect them to have wisdom because they're not that old. They don't have any life experience.
Yeah.
I mean, once you're old like we are and life has, like, kicked you in the ass a few times.
Yeah, your perspective has changed a lot. By the time you don't really understand. You don't really get any grasp over the game. You didn't even know it was a game until you got to about 40. And you go, I see the game they're playing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mango said, I enjoyed the second story of the episode, but it took a bit of time to get going. Yeah, I think that's kind of what I'd say. Once it got going and you figured out what was going on, it was good then. But I think they could have done with a little bit less of her talking.
Yeah.
Because she kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because and even Molly Ringwald was kind of like, it was trying to go a little meta because she's like, can you please just get to the point what you're talking about? Like with your brother trying to kill you and all this other kind of shit. But yeah, so I definitely preferred the first one, the sci-fi one. But yeah, this was another pretty solid episode all around. So, you know, good job, Shudder. We're liking them so far. Yeah. All right. So do you want to talk about the loved one?
Yeah.
We've been kind of referring to this a few times, like on some of our last shows, and we finally got it. He got it on DVD, Blu-ray?
On DVD.
Yeah.
It wasn't really worth spending the extra $10 for Blu-ray in a black and white movie.
True.
That, you know, had all the same features and everything, so I just got it in DVD. It looked good. This is a weird movie.
And it is very weird.
This is the only movie that I knew of that was weird that Jenny had never heard of. I showed her this movie. She said, man, I can't believe I've never seen this movie.
Oh, you know what? No, there was one more. Brimstone and Treacle.
Yeah, you didn't know about that one either, did you?
Although I had seen some other movies and read some other books by the same author, but I didn't know that one.
We need to Brimstone and
Treacle. We do. I really like that movie a lot. Yeah. Sting was in it.
About a demon, I guess.
Yeah, sort of.
A demon. Played by Sting.
Yeah, we'll have to find that. That's a very weird movie too.
Yeah.
But yeah, so The Loved One, it came out in 1965. What ended up happening with this was that Evelyn Waugh, the British writer, you know, he wrote a lot of satire and stuff like that. He also wrote Brideshead Revisited, which has been adapted for movies like a zillion times. And I guess back in the 40s, he got like a shit ton of money for the rights to Brideshead Revisited, even though none of the executives at the studio had even read it. So he used that money to come over here, And he wanted to kind of direct the movie or be like, you know, he wanted to have control over it. And they were like, yeah, no. And then they just said, forget it, and didn't do it. While he was in L.A., like doing meetings with that, he got kind of fascinated about with the American funerary industry, the funeral industry, yeah. And decided to write a he wrote like a big long article about it. And then he turned it into a book called The Loved One. And that is what this movie is based on. And I guess they tried to make this a movie a couple of times. I think even, what's his name that hung out with Salvador Dali? Luis Buñuel?
Yeah, that's funny.
He tried to make it too.
Yeah, because there's a lot of absurdism in this.
It is very absurdist. This is along the same lines as if you're into shit like Dr. Strangelove. Yeah. This is very like Dr. Strangelove. Right. Or like The Magic Christian. Or like a lot of movies like that that came out around that time that are real kind of satirical, weird, absurdist. It's in that kind of vein. It's almost like more British sense of humor, obviously, because it was written
by... Some of the characters are British, too.
And it was written by a Brit, and the screenwriters were British, too.
And he's kind of just experiencing kind of the absurdism of California of the 60s and the industries, the big corporate industries of the 60s, including, like, the space industry and just everything, you know what I mean? Hollywood, you know, how absurd that is. It's just, it's a weird flick, and it's kind of goth in a way. It has a lot of goth fucking sensibilities to it.
It does, yeah.
This British guy shows up in California without really a pot to piss in and no money. And he meets up with his uncle, who's an old Hollywood queen who's been working.
John Gielgud. Yeah, this is a star-studded.
Yeah. Movie. Everybody in this is a star. And he's got this recreation of a damn British cottage that he lives in inside Hollywood. And, you know, Hollywood was fake as fuck back in the 60s. It's still fake as fuck. Well, it's not even there anymore, I don't think. Not in the form that it's shown in this movie. And it's... It just shows the absurdism that was going on inside the Hollywood studios. And this dude had been, his uncle had been like a loyal actor and employee for this studio for like 35 fucking years. And they basically fire him over nothing. And kind of accuse him of being a thief in a way on his way out the damn door, which he didn't steal the fucking painting.
Yeah.
Then he goes home and commits suicide. And his young nephew finds him hanging, literally, by his neck. All the British expats are in this, basically, this group run by the oldest, most noble Britishman. And he's holding all these British people to the British standard. He's like, whether you like it or not, you are ambassadors of the fucking, you know, of the queen and all this kind of shit. They have to have meetings. They watch each other. They fucking judge each other by what their jobs are. And it's just crazy. They make this kid sign over all of his uncle's possessions to like a foundation to have him buried in style in this place called Whispering Glades, which to be buried there fucking costs hundreds and hundreds of thousands of fucking dollars.
Yeah, it's like this massive
fucking cemetery. Graveyard.
And it's got like all these sections and neighborhoods like the Falls of Xanadu,
the Whispering Glades. and it's like a theme park.
Yeah.
All right. And it has, the motif of it is fucking great, really, all right? It's non-sectarian. Which in the American world, that would mean just generic Christian. But when it's generic Christian in the United States, what you're talking about is like Southern Baptist. And they look like Baptist ministers and televangelists. That's what everything is kind of after. The visual look is Greek mixed with, I don't know, the Haunted Mansion from Disneyland?
Yeah, a little bit.
Some Victorian highlights? It's staffed by all these hotties, these fucking hottie goth chicks in these weird 60s flight attendant / Morticia Adams outfits.
It almost kind of looks like, maybe this is one of the things, because I remember the poster saying it's like there's something in it to offend everyone. And it's obviously it's not offensive by today's standards, but I can see how it would have been offensive in 1965. The outfits that a lot of the women are wearing at Whispering Glades, they're really cool. They almost,
I like Morticia Adams.
I might be remembering this wrong, but it looks a little bit like Jackie Kennedy's mourning outfit.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of
like when her husband died.
Kind of like Morticia Adams / 1960s flight attendants with veils and weird fucking hats. And they're all color coordinated depending on what their rank is and what their jobs are. And they all look kind of look like models. They all look like models. And they're constantly flirting at the guy, flirting with the guys, and they don't. It's just as shit unfolds, you find out it's real irreverent. You know what I mean? They act very professional, but that's not what's actually going on at this place. It's
run by this reverend,
the reverend,
played by Jonathan Winters. Yeah, he plays two roles in this. He plays brothers.
Yeah, he plays the reverend and his twin brother.
Yeah,
and the twin brother owns the fucking cheap ass pet. He runs the cheap ass pet cemetery up the road.
Happier hunting ground.
It's all part of the fucking story. Well, he gets involved with, Barry and his uncle, and he gets a tour, and his place is fucking amazing. It is amazing. Wherever you go, they got the damn huge statues of the reverend, and they press a button, and a recording of him fucking booms out, and he says all this magnificent crap. You know, it's just crap, you know. Welcome to Whispering Glades, where for eternity, your soul. So he goes through the whole Barry and his uncle thing, and there's all these different options. About
Liberace shows you.
Liberace's in it. And he's fucking, and he's
just, he works there. He's the one that shows you all the coffins and whatnot.
There's a bunch of gay innuendo. If you didn't, now that you know that Liberace is gay, the average person probably back in the day probably didn't know that Liberace was gay.
Well, insider people knew, but I don't think.
Insider people knew.
Yeah.
Remember when they had the damn sex party?
Yeah.
And all the generals, the Air Force generals, are opening up the caskets.
And all the hot girls are popping out of the coffins.
One general opens it up and fucking Liberace comes out and asks for a cigarette. that was some innuendo right there. Okay. It's just a great flick. It's fucking weird.
Got to say that when he gets there, the kid gets there, his name's Dennis Barlow, by the way, in the movie. He's played by Robert Morse.
He meets this chick.
Who is a cosmetologist for the dead.
Yeah.
And her name is Amy Fanatogenous.
Yeah, it has the French spelling with the two E's.
Well, she's supposedly named after Amy Semple McPherson, who was like a really famous, in real life, she was a real famous evangelist in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, so she's wearing this white fucking outfit this morning. She's a beautician for the dead.
Yeah.
She does their faces and stuff. And, she's cute as hell. You know, she's a good-looking actress, and she's just this very innocent, fucking kind of naive, idealistic, goth-adjacent type 60s chick. I guess, I don't know what
she believes in
all this shit for real.
Yeah, in all this stuff for real. Like, she doesn't understand that
it's a business.
That it's just like a crass corporate kind of crap. She really actually believes in, you know, these people are for eternity, and she's super into her job.
Yeah. So most of the movie's about this British guy. He meets her, and he falls in lust with her, really. And he's kind of like got a Beatles haircut. He's kind of like a 60s cool guy. He doesn't have a pot to piss in, no money or anything. And he just tries to talk his way up this chick's skirt through the whole fucking
by using other people's poetry, but she doesn't realize it. He's like quoting like Shakespeare sonnets and like Robert Herrick and stuff at her, and it's like
now when he shows up, he doesn't know it, but she is already kind of in this flirtatious relationship with a guy she works with who's about 50. He's the head mortician.
Mortician, yeah.
And the name of his character is Mr. Joy Boy.
Played by Rod Steiger.
Yeah. And he fucking, you know what I mean? He's a lot like her, actually. He's another one that really believes this stuff. He believes in fucking vows of fucking, remember that? He said, I can't do that. I'm breaking my vow.
Yeah.
He's a true believer in the shit, too. But he gets in between him and fucking, it's a big kind of love triangle. Mr. Joy Boy finds out that fucking the dude's pilfering all this fucking poetry. He tries to expose him. He's trying to get the girl. They're both trying to get the girl.
Yeah, it's like a love triangle type of thing.
They're both trying to get the girl. And then some crazy shit's going on. Amy's writing to this fucking Indian guru. who's giving her the advice of which man to fucking pick, right? But it turns out it's just this dude that works up the fucking road at the damn at the newspaper.
He's just like an old drunk.
Old drunk guy. Look at this, the ghoul from the graveyard. He's one of those kind of guys.
Tell him to marry the other.
Tell him to marry the other. You know, he thinks she's a nut. When he finally meets her in the bar, he's like, oh, look at you. It's the ghoul from the graveyard. You know? He sounds exactly...
There is so much crazy shit in
there. Yeah.
We haven't even mentioned Mr. Joy Boy's mom.
Yeah, he lives with his mom. He's taking care of his mom. And all his role is just to take care of his mom and to feed her. She's fucking morbidly obese. He cooks whole pigs for her. Fucking just piles food on her. When he's not around, she dumps the refrigerator on herself and just fucking lays on the floor and eating it. And There's some underlying messages there, you know what I mean? He tells Amy that he had a dream that he was cooking up all these lobsters for her, and they were undercooked, and she says, oh, don't worry, I'll eat them anyway. So she starts eating the raw lobsters, and the lobsters are eating, you know, fought back and started eating her, and her and the lobsters are eating each other, and that was his nightmare. And there's a bunch of, I guess you could say, moral lessons. Amy was kind of, you find out that Amy is... She's just dedicated herself to this funeral business that doesn't really give a shit about her, okay? And Joy Boy has kind of dedicated himself to being a good son and dedicated himself to taking care of his mom, and she doesn't really give a shit about him either. When he's not around, she's like, oh, yeah, him. She's kind of using
She him. Just wants the food.
She just wants the food. And he's kind of given up his whole personal life, really, to take care of his mom. He's kind of his mama's boy. It's just... I don't want to spoil it because if you guys haven't seen it,
because I feel like a lot of people haven't.
Yeah,
seen it.
This is a weird gem.
I want to say too. We also didn't even mention at the pet cemetery. There's also Paul Williams.
Yeah, yeah.
Plays a kid.
Yeah.
Builds rockets.
Right. He can build a rocket from scratch. And this is in a time when rocket science was the fucking top science. If you could build a rocket, then you were the shit. Well, back at Whispering Glades, the guy who owns it, played by Jonathan Winters, he's this mysterious fucking character that runs around in a damn helicopter dressed in all black with this fucking hat. And he's got this assistant, this chick, I guess it's assistant slash girlfriend, and she's just smoking hot. I mean, when you see her, she's in like one of those funeral outfits. It's like a business suit with glasses, black glasses.
Yeah, she's got really dark like sunglasses.
Yeah, and this fucking hat. Like
she doesn't talk though, does she? I don't think she ever.
No, she doesn't say anything. She's just back there. But you kind of have the feeling that she's like kind of not controlling him, but that she's like his right hand man in a way.
Yeah,
there was some kind of power dynamic going on. But wherever he was, she was right there taking notes and doing things. I guess it was like his main secretary. It's his secretary. Yeah. It's supposed to be. But you could tell it's his girlfriend. And he's got his brother. He calls his brother out of retirement for being a loser and puts him in charge of the pet cemetery.
Yeah.
And while he's at the pet cemetery, his other twin brother... He's teaching, okay, Amy's boyfriend, the British guy, goes to work for this pet cemetery to try to make some kind of money to impress Amy. But then when Amy finds out he's working there, she's fucking flabbergasted because she thinks burying pets is fucking...
Sacrilegious. She's like a true believer. Like
yeah.
She's very...
Yeah. But it's not Christianity.
Not really.
It's just... Her name is Amy Thanatogenes.
Yeah.
But they're talking about Thanatos,
yeah,
the god of death.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she is kind of a morbid kind of chick. She lives on a house that got condemned during construction because they were building it on a slide zone and it's one overlooking LA. She's living in it anyway, tearing the damn posters the off. And when he walked in, it didn't even have walls, it just had chicken wire and stuff. And it had all these beautiful chandeliers and stuff she got from the cemetery, I believe. The real chandeliers and statuary and stuff. And he walks in there with her and the thing starts going, brr, like it's going to fall. And he's like, what the fuck? There's no longer built the slide zone. Isn't this going to fall? And she's like, oh, I suppose it will. And then she goes on the back and she's swinging swinging, and the whole house is getting ready to like fall off. And she says, I don't care about things that are practical. I only surround myself with things that are beautiful, which that's kind of like, that's kind of what that character was about. It didn't have anything to do with practicality. It was this fantasy idea of beauty.
Well, she's a very wide-eyed, naive character, but she's not, but she's also a really lovable character.
Yeah, she's not. It's just that she's totally blissfully unaware of danger and the repercussions.
She's like completely pure.
Yeah.
And she doesn't understand that the world is not.
Right, yeah.
You know what I mean? So she's like completely innocent.
Yeah. And I think in the end, when you find out, I think Mr. Joy Boy was kind of like the male representation of the of that same character. They were different, you know what I mean, in how they manifested, but they were kind of peas in a pod, really.
They were kind of like the only people that weren't completely cynical.
They weren't cynical, right. They actually believed in what they were doing, even though what they were doing was basically self-destructive.
Yeah.
Because they weren't aware of the evil of other people. I think that's really what it meant.
Yeah.
Make a long story short.
Too late.
Too late. The guy who owns Whispering Glades decides that there's no that they're going to run out of space soon at the rate that they're filling the place up. And once that happens, they won't be able to afford the overheads and that the business will go bust. So the best course of action is to change the cemetery into a convalescent home.
Yeah.
Because old people constantly appear every year and it has a brisk turnover. So he wanted to turn it into a futuristic glass and stainless steel city of the elderly, you know, to launch them off into the fucking afterlife and shit. But he couldn't do it because there was all those damn dead bodies on the property. So through his brother who has the fucking pet cemetery, they find out that they have a little kid that can make rockets rockets. And they ask the kid, how are we going to get all these fucking bodies out of here? And he starts talking about the ICBMs that the Air Force has. So what's the guy's name? What's the Jonathan Winter's name? The guy who owns Whispering Glade?
I think it was Glenworthy.
Fucking has all these Air Force generals over and he plies them with booze and women to sell him ICBMs to launch all these damn dead people into orbit, and they were going to be in a celestial orbit of eternity. And he's wording it in a real fucking beautiful way. And shit, I don't know if I should spoil the end.
You should don't.
Yeah, I can't spoil the end because it gets pretty interesting, but it wraps up very quickly. I thought there was more to it, how it ended. Back, we don't have all of the cultural context because it was written for another generation. And I think there were some certain things that about it that were very unusual to them, but to us are just, that's like a normal thing.
You know what I'm talking
about? But not back in those days. So we don't have all the cultural context, but it still holds up. It holds up as a strange and enjoyable movie.
Yeah, it's a very, very weird. Like I said, if you're into Dr. Strangelove and stuff like that, the only thing that I didn't remember, because we saw this several years ago, and then I hadn't seen it for a long time, and then we got it and we watched it the other night or yesterday. And I had forgotten that a lot of it was like dubbed over.
Yeah.
Which is very weird. Like, I know that they dubbed some of Jonathan Winter's lines because I think that they changed one of the characters' names like in the middle. So they had to dub him over like him calling his brother by the other name because I guess they changed the character name. I think they also Robert Morse's character, he plays like the main kid, Dennis Barlow. I think that he's American and they wanted him to be a Brit. And I don't know if that's him doing the British accent and then they just dubbed it over or if they got somebody else to dub him over doing a British accent. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm not really sure what his actual voice sounds like.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of it seemed dubbed, which I thought was really weird. Roddy McDowell is in this too.
Yeah, he's in it for, so is Milton Berle.
Milton Berle is in it for a second in like a really weird scene. James Coburn is in it for a second. He was like the dude at the airport. It was like a cameo.
Yeah. I think what made the movie, interesting for its day, that might be lost in translation for to the average person is that this is for a 60s audience, and they're showing a world in which the military complexes can be corrupted by booze and women, and that religion and the funeral business are just kind of irreverent businesses like any other business.
Yeah.
And I think those were kind of, like, nowadays we know that. People grew
up so
with
it's
that.
Not a big deal, and it doesn't that doesn't really offend anybody.
But back in those days, I think.
But in the 60s, that probably would have read a lot.
That was kind of a new
sure.
concept, right? The idea that some characters believe in fake shit just wholeheartedly. That I think that was kind of, that might have been disturbing to them back then, because a lot of people believed in a lot of fake shit wholeheartedly back then.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, back then they still believed in evangelism.
Yeah.
Like that was a real thing. Then televangelists appeared eventually.
Yeah.
And then that kind of eroded the credibility of evangelists.
That's true.
You know, well, I mean? This is pre all that.
Like I said, I kind of feel like that's why it was significant that her name was Amy, like the spelled the French way. And she even says in the movie that she was named after Amy Semple McPherson, who, like I said, was a very famous evangelist, like in the 20s and 30s, like one of the first ones to gain like nationwide.
Yes, that whole concept of religion and death being a bit in a corporate business, being business. I think that that bothered people back then.
Yeah. I think. And in a lot of ways, like I said, it's a funny movie. It's a satire. And just showing everyone behind the scenes as just being these cynical.
Yeah.
Kind of like, So I can see how that would have been offensive in the 60s. Sure.
Because you find
in the mid-60s.
Because you find out a bunch of shit about Glenworthy. She was holding Glenworthy up to be like a godlike being, you know, who helped people achieve peace in the afterlife. And that he was ethical, you know. She didn't really say anything about morality. She always mentioned ethics.
Yeah.
And she really didn't say anything about Jesus or Christianity. It wasn't about that. They took that element away. She was kind of like non-sectarian, like a Scientologist is what she was like.
Yeah. Kind of. I mean, it had some of the trappings of Christianity.
Yeah, the physical trappings.
And there was one scene where a Jewish couple came in and wanted to buy a plot, and they were turned away.
Yeah, they were just sent to another place.
They were like, why don't you go over there? You'd be much happier. You know what I mean? So it was kind of Christianity adjacent.
Yeah. Well, actually, there was more to it than that. If you noticed that when they asked him who the loved one that he was burying, his British uncle, they asked him what race he was, and they said, is he Caucasian? And he goes, well, no, he's white. And he goes, well, Caucasian is white. And they said, that's good. And then they were asking, right. So to be married, to be buried at Whispering Glades, you had to be like a Anglo-Saxon Protestant. You couldn't be Jewish.
Yeah.
You couldn't be black.
Yeah.
Anything like that. You had to be a WASP. You had to be a WASP. White Anglo-Saxon
Pretty much,
Protestant.
Yeah.
You know, which. A lot during that time, you know, a lot of evangelistic activity was very WASPy.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't mean that, you know, black people were banned or anything, but it just meant it just attracted white people.
That's kind of what this was subverting and kind of making fun of.
Making fun of it. Right.
Yeah. Which, like I said, I can see how that in 1965, that would have been offensive.
Well, in 65,
to the squares.
In 65, in some areas, like certain like country clubs wouldn't allow Jews.
Oh yeah, I know.
And that was pretty common.
Yeah.
But it wasn't official. It was just that they made sure that maybe you'd be happier somewhere else.
Yeah.
Know? But that wasn't written down on the damn paperwork. That would have been
gauche.
Well, I think it would have been that might have been a lawsuit. You could probably get in a lawsuit back.
Yeah, they didn't want anything.
They had other ways.
They had other ways. Everything was kind of like nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Yeah, you're like, no.
Yeah, which, you know, that's kind of what they showed in this one.
Yeah.
I think you'd be much happier at this other,
cemetery. Yeah, go be buried with those people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had totally forgotten about them asking about him being Caucasian. He's like, no, he's not Caucasian. He's white.
They wanted to make sure he was white.
There's so many weird scenes of this. I was just thinking of the scene of Mr. Joy Boy doing John Gielgud's face, trying to get his facial expression right when he was dead. You know what I mean? And he's like, going back like that, and then he'd have a different expression.
Mr. Joy Boy was like, he would arrange. He didn't do... Was he doing the makeup or did Thanatogenes do the makeup?
I guess he...
He arranged the faces.
Arranged the face.
And dressed them and shit.
Dressed them and right. stuff. And then she would, did the makeup.
Yeah, and he would flirt with her by sending the bodies to her in certain fucking facial expressions and shit.
Yeah, to like make her smile.
Yeah, and then he'd go out there and flirt with her, and all the other fucking cosmetologists and shit, and all the other mortician girls would be like giving her hate looks because they were evidently kind of vying for this guy. It was like a cult, and it was very, very much a hierarchy of who had what job,
yeah,
and how long they had been there, and were they an embalmer or not an embalmer, that kind of stuff. So these girls were actually going after, they were kind of vying for Joy Boy. They were jealous that she was getting all the attention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and she was going to get, because he put in for her for promotion, right?
Yeah.
She was going to be like the first lady embalmer.
Yeah.
She was very, I'll be the first lady.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She was so excited.
Yeah.
Aw.
But you can watch it. Amazon has it. You can live stream it. I think that's only $1.99 or $2.99. You can live stream it. I recommend it. It's a fun movie to watch.
Yeah. Good, like yeah. I said, if you're into like a lot of those weird 60s
yeah.
kind of movies, you know, and you haven't seen it. Because like I said, it's. I feel like I hadn't seen it, and that's yeah. unusual.
It's funny. It's kind of spooky. It has some 60s hotties in it. It has a death theme. It's kind of gothic in certain spots. Real irreverent in certain other spots. But it's just kind of a... Not all of it translates to today, but it's just kind of it was kind of eerie. The movie had a weird eeriness to it.
A little bit, yeah. A little bit, kind of
strange.
It's just the only thing, you know, the cinematography is beautiful. It's actually Haxel Wexler did that, who's, like I said, he's probably one of the most famous cinematographers of all time. But yeah, the dubbing is a little weird and the edit is a little weird, but other than that, because, like, some of the scenes sort of end sort of abruptly, which is kind of strange. But, yeah, other than that, it's just like a bizarre
movie.
Movie.
Yeah. You never can tell what's going to happen next.
True. Yeah. That's true. It's just kind of, like, one absurdist kind of
thing.
I mean, there is a plot. Like, you know, this happens because of this and whatnot. But then there's all kind of these just weird...
Yeah.
these weird kind of surreal...
I can't really... There's no other movie like this.
Not really. Like I said, it kind of gives me a vibe like some of those trippy 60s movies, like maybe, like I said, like Dr. Strangelove or...
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Kind of like Strangelove. That's the closest thing I can...
That's the closest thing I can think of to it.
Yeah.
But I was reading a review of it and somebody mentioned The Magic Christian, which...
Never seen it.
Wasn't fucking Ringo Starr in that? I want to say Ringo Starr was in that. And I was like, yeah, something like that. If you're into like British humor, because it has kind of like a British
kind of dry humor
sensibility to it. It's like, yeah, it's much, much drier than an American comedy would be.
Yeah.
All right. So we done?
Yeah, we're done.
All right. All right. So we will be back tomorrow. Probably tomorrow we're going to do a food show. Yeah.
Yeah, we can do that.
We're going to talk about curry tomorrow.
Okay.
And so, yeah. Thanks, everybody, for dropping by as usual. And we'll be back tomorrow at 3 p.m. So have a good rest of your weekend, and we'll see you tomorrow. Bye.